And welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is someone who is currently enjoying a delicious slice of chocolate cake. It's Lisa Leahy.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Good. How's that cake treating you?
It's some good cake. I'll tell you, there's nothing like some walnut to make a sweet that much better.
And chopping lots and lots of walnuts, by the way.
Absolutely, with a giant knife.
And so
how else do you do it?
We'll get into that later. I don't want to make fun of allergies because I have a shellfish allergy. And I remember 2 years ago, I was in Maine and they were steaming lobsters. And I was like, oh, I'm okay because I'm not eating it. But the steam got in my throat. And
I looked
at my wife and my mother-in-law and I went, can you two breathe? And they're like, yeah, we're fine. So I had to run outside and air just from the steam with like the lobster proteins in them. So I totally get, well, I don't totally get what happened to poor Charlie, but I get those allergies. They're no fun, but
That's scary.
Yeah.
I don't have any, fortunately, like, I guess fortunately for me, but, you know, being a teacher, obviously, like, you have to be hyper aware of those kinds of things. And I mean, we can get into more detail when we get there, but just, like, the idea of my throat's getting bigger, like, I can't imagine that kind of terror, that kind of, I can't fix this. So, I mean, that alone is horrifying in itself. So I can't imagine being out in the restaurant and just suddenly not being able to breathe just because you're breathing the air. Oh, my goodness.
It was wild. And I think it's a bit of karma because when when Megan was my girlfriend, she made shrimp one night for us. And so I ate mine a lot quicker. And so she had some left. So I kissed her. And like when I was kissing her, I grabbed one of her shrimp and I stole it from her. So I'm not saying that's what gave me the shrimp allergy, but it's a bit of karma there because I stole her shrimp.
Goodness.
And you develop it later in life, some of these allergies. So I just remember I stole her shrimp. A few months later, I'm allergic to shellfish.
Oh, no. I think she might have, you know, put a hex on you. You might want to look out for Megan.
Is that why triangles and little things are written on the walls in my entire home and I smell something in the attic?
No, that's totally just part of the decor.
Wait, am I getting paymoned?
I don't know anything about that. Sorry.
Wait, but didn't you tell me a story one day outside of a craft store about what happened to your?
Yeah, you're right. When I bought that chalkboard.
Yeah. Oh.
Was that what it was? Yeah, it was the chalkboard, right? That was in the back of the hatch.
Oh, okay. So I just want to say I brought Lisa. I brought you in to talk about Brightburn as our last episode. And that's a movie that you enjoy because you're really big into villains.
I am.
I was not really into Brightburn. And we had a good time, though, unpacking it, examining why it has such a cult audience and talking about it. And I love that. And I got talking to you again about what are the other movies you love. And you brought up Hereditary. And this is a movie, I mean, 89% Rotten Tomatoes. It had Oscar buzz. Toni Collette didn't get nominated. People are really angry. Ari Aster directed
it. Still aggravated about that. Yep.
I mean, the cinematography by Paul Pogorzelski is excellent. Grace Yoon is the production designer, and they built this really neat house on the stage that's meant to mimic a dollhouse. And technically speaking, with the shots and the performances, and I mean, these actors gave everything. Alex Wolff had to go to therapy after this because this role tore him up so much. This is a visually impressive, well-made, well-conceived film that fell completely flat to me. And I understand that I'm in the minority, and I'm not like an A24 hate. I love A24. We did the best horror films of the 2010s, and Zach Beckler and I, who's also a horror director, we said Green Room was our favorite horror film of the 2010s. I love The Witch, and I love the discussion is how, you know, since we're fans of horror, Lisa, it's been really neat since maybe, 2014, 2015, 2016, when we started getting Spring, The Witch. We started It Follows, these art house horror movies, The Babadook.
Tension builders. Like, they're not films that rely on gore and silly jump scares.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's what I appreciate about them. You know, you've got films that just, I go back to The Strangers, and what was that, 2008?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember that film really standing out to me as an incredible slow burn that just creeps under your skin and just won't let go. And I love A24. I think A24 is incredible at the slow burn horror where you just don't feel right. You know, like, you can go see a Friday the 13th movie, or you could go see Texas Chainsaw, and you know they're going to be gross, and you know they're going to be weird, and they're going to be, you know, people's bodies left and right, and you kind of laugh at the silliness of some of it, and, you know, oh, there's some gore. I mean, you go into a movie like The Human Centipede, and you know it's just going to be gross.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of horror than what A24 really does, like, in general. A24 has these movie makers who just know how to not make you feel right. Like, it's that psychological bug that gets into your brain and you're just done for. Like, you love it or you hate it. You can't stop talking about it right away.
For me, I love it. I fully embrace A24. I know like some people kind of make fun of their movies, and I know that the so-called like hardcore horror fans, who are essentially just slasher fans from the 80s and they hate when horror's not that, they really dislike these movies because the way they're marketed sometimes, the way they're shown to audiences, they're very slow burny. Sometimes they get a little too precious. I think the way for Hereditary for me, though, is like The Black Coat's Daughter is one of my favorite horror films of the last, I don't know, 20 years. Have you seen The Black Coat's Daughter?
Shame on me, I haven't. Oh. I have the book. Wow. It's actually sitting... Oh, no, that's The Boatman's Daughter. Never mind.
The Old Man in the Sea?
I keep... Oh, God, I hate that book. That book. So, terrible book ever.
I don't want to give away too much for you then about it, but it's about loneliness and how...
Okay.
And just... There's a couple lines in it that gut me. And the movie Session 9 absolutely wrecks me, how Simon pursues the weak. I think The Dark and the Wicked is another movie about alienation and this demon who wants you weak. And I see the DNA of Hereditary in this. Like, this cult wants to weaken this family and then take them over.
Yes.
But the thing for me, though, is from the beginning, I don't know why. And we were just talking about this off air. I don't really examine movies to look for twists. I really just try to let movies wash over me.
Absolutely.
But from the beginning of this one... Like, I don't know who most of you people are. I'm like, oh, she's into something. And then the creeper stares. And then you just see triangles in rooms. You hear the clucking. You hear the birds. You hear the treehouse. You see the breathing outside. You see the writing on the walls. I knew immediately that Anne Dowd was someone who was up to no good. And when she taught her that... When she taught
that
her...
incantation. Yeah, I was just like, oh, read man. It. Don't worry what language it is.
Yeah, I was like, she is setting you up. And then just watching... This cult who for 40 years has tried to put this one of the gods of hell into someone so they can get riches. And the clip, so I tried to watch everything I could about Hereditary, all the making ofs, all the documentaries, the dead meats, the explained. I watch everything wrong with it. And I love that the guy in the everything wrong with Hereditary is like, this movie is 67% foreshadowing. And that is correct. And I also think that they said that this is an Ocean's 11 movie, but for a coven. And they're just, it's about a bunch of...
That's a great way of putting it.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It's about a bunch of Paimon worshippers who have spent 40 years trying to put this into a male host.
Yes.
Just so they can get rich. And the whole, like, what I don't like is, I'm talking a lot, Lisa. You are very eloquent and you have The Sibilist, your new podcast. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
I just haven't been able to dump this for a long time, so I really appreciate you letting me unpack.
Oh, don't worry. I'll get my turn. Yeah,
if I'm unpacking, I have like a suitcase the size of a room here. But it's this family, and Zach Beckler and I were talking about this. He directed a wonderful movie called Interior. It's on Amazon Prime. Basically what I said this movie was I felt like I was walking towards a mountain that was 50 miles away, and it still looks huge, and you just walk towards it. You know exactly what's coming. Like the mountain, like there's... you just see it, and you just walk towards it slowly. I knew exactly, I don't know why, but everything in this movie, setting them up, like just putting them in, I don't know. And my buddy's like, exactly, that's why you're so gutted at what's happening to this family.
Mm-hmm.
But this family, from the start, they're very, it's very dour. They're very down. We never see them happy. We never see them enjoying it. So as they're getting torn apart, we've never had enough alone moments for them. And people say that this movie explores grief. This and like mental illness. But Ari Aster said that there isn't any mental illness in it. It's just about a mom, a grandma, who wants money and puts their people through the ringer. And it just, I think it takes out any agency. I think it takes out any grief. I think it takes out what makes, one of my favorite movies is Take Shelter. The ending of that movie.
That's an amazing film too.
Guts me. When you see him and it's like, is it schizophrenia? Is it the end of the world? And it gives them agency. And like the latest Halloween movie, all agency was taken away from Michael Myers. His bus was wrecked by the doctor. He escaped. He got hit by a car and brought through Laurie Strode's house. It's the least frightening Michael Myers ever. And in this one, it's this cult who we never spend time with. They just want money. We have a already dour family surrounded by beautiful cinematography and performances, but nothing about this movie made me feel anything. I felt no grief. I felt no terror. I was like, man, these people put a lot of work into wiping this family out to get some change. Like I bet you some of the original members are dead. Like they got brand new. Like what if you're a member of Paimon and you've been there for 6 months? Like you're not, like, it's just, I felt nothing. I didn't like the villains. They just want some change in their pockets. There's nothing really scary about it. They show you the triangles on the ground. They're like, oh, that's fine. They show you the body who disappears. I'm like, oh, they took that. Like everything about this movie. Oh, where's that rug? I'm like, great. She's part of this. And the miniatures, like everything is just, it's all like, people are like, things you missed in Hereditary. And I'm like, no, you didn't miss anything in Hereditary.
Because
they show, right, Lisa, they show you everything. And so this movie has had no surprises for me. And I know everyone's like, man, Mark is being negative, but like, I'm not used to this. 6 years of Mark talking, and this is the first of a beloved horror film.
This is a huge episode. That's your tagline right there. In 6 years, this is the first episode where Mark rants.
Yeah, and but I don't want to be the person who hates it because it's A24. Like we talked about it. I love the movie Mother. Mm-hmm. I don't go into movies with expectations, or I don't let trailers fool me. I just, watching this movie, I don't even think I watched a trailer for it because I just heard the review. So I'm like, I'm going to go in and watch this. So I wasn't sullied by a preview. It was a, kind of a me watching it. And I don't know. I'm going to hear, how'd you enjoy this? What was your experience like with it?
So it's funny that you say there were no surprises, because when I watch horror films, I've seen far too many. I've seen far too many movies in general. Jump scares do not work on me. The only jump scare that will work on me every single darn time, to the point that I'm aggravated by it, is when you've got somebody driving along and there's like another car or a truck that like slams into them. Every single time that will make
me. Like Final Destination?
Oh my God. Well, it just like, there's two different reasons for it. People who know me will go, well, it's because of this. The other reason is I don't know why. For some reason, maybe something in my brain. So in 2014, I was actually struck by an SUV while I was walking in a crosswalk.
Oh, wow.
So I'm good. I'm fine. I can walk, but I have a metal rod in my leg. It's a whole thing. But don't use your phone while you're texting. Or don't use your phone while you're driving. A teenage 17-year-old girl got out of the car with her phone in her hand.
Oh.
So it's a whole other thing. So don't be texting while you're driving. But, you know, watching Insidious 3 really whacked me one, because I never saw
thing?
That coming.
Well, the crunchy legs?
She gets hit by a car, and that's how she ends up in the thing. But even before, the only jump scare that would ever work is that car coming out of nowhere. So I go into these films. I see the jump scare coming, as you do once you've gotten used to these patterns. So I go into Hereditary. Like you, I didn't know anything about it because I knew there was a scary movie coming. I knew it was about a matriarch who passes away, and that was it. I knew Toni Collette was in it because I have my trailer blackout thing. So I sit down in the theater. This is the only film that not only has the jump scare worked, I sat up and exclaimed out loud in the theater. I sat up and went, Jesus Christ! In the theater out loud in this movie. And I'm like, this is the greatest movie in the history of the world, because I don't even flinch with jump scares, except like I said, if somebody gets hit by a car. But I mean, for me to sit up, for me to not only react out loud verbally, but to like words out loud. I mean, people must have thought I was insane, and I did not care. I left the movie theater. I go see movies by myself all the time, more often than I go with other people. I got in the car, and I remember calling my mother saying, we need to see this movie. Will you come with me and see it again? She's like, I have no interest in this. And I just started yammering at her about all the amazing things about this movie. And I couldn't shut up about it for the next couple of days. So that I went and I saw it again. I saw this twice in the theater in the same week because I couldn't get enough of this movie. I don't care that I knew things. I don't care that I saw the mystery coming because, like you, I don't sit there and try and figure things out. So if I figure out your movie and you're supposed to be a mystery, I get annoyed. Like, for example, with Knives Out, I had half of it within the first maybe 20 minutes or so. It was more of the how it was done that I didn't know, but I knew it was done to, you know, protect people from spoilers if you still haven't seen that movie. But this movie, it's not about that, in my opinion. I don't think it's a mystery.
No. Yeah, you're right. Great point.
I mean, I think it's, and you talk about grief, and good Lord, Toni Collette's grief, but and not even for her mother. I don't know when you reveal spoilers in your podcast episodes.
Beginning, all like immediately.
So let's go. All right. Yeah. So when Charlie is dealing with that awful allergic reaction and is hanging out of the car as her brother speeds to the hospital and is decapitated by the pole, I even was shown the pole and I didn't think that kind of thing was coming. I thought he would hit the pole, not her head. Just like that scene is just goes down in history as one of the greatest surprises for me in film. But
Can I clarify one thing just so we're on the same page? So like I didn't see the decapitation coming. I didn't know that Charlie was gonna lose her head.
I don't think anybody did. God help you.
I did know that they focus on the sign and you see that symbol of it, and I'm like, oh great. Yeah. And then I guess the most annoying thing for me is I got thinking, like, they put that deer in the road, hoping that this allergic reaction to nuts, and then she would have her head out there, she would get decapitated so her spirit would leave her, and then Ann Dowd would be like, yo, take this in your thing so that we can put it in you. And it's just, then...
I think that's a little, I don't think they expected quite so much.
They're just, like, are they just running around putting out little traps to kill her? Like, since Grandma died, are they like, all right, let's kill Charlie, but let's put nuts at a party, let's incept some nuts, let's lay this deer there, because that symbol was on that pole.
It is on the pole, yes. So I think that there was definitely some mystical incantation that they were hoping for, some kind of terrible accident. I don't think they set the nuts up to happen. I think that was just sort of a wonderful convenience for them. I don't know. I think they were hoping for... I think if nothing happened at that party, he would have been high. He might have gotten drunk, even though he said he wasn't going to drink. I don't know. I feel like there had been some kind of push that there would have been an accident. I don't think that they laid out that her head was going to come off and this horrific thing was going to occur.
So are the demon people at their potluck just going, can you believe what happened?
Like, probably.
Like, they're doing their incantation, like, give me the money.
Oh my God. Like, can you, I just.
I totally hijacked what you were saying, so
I don't even know that I was being coherent at that point. We were talking about the grief. So, honestly, the phrase that I repeated over and over again in my notes was poor Steve, because Gabriel Byrne's character of Steven is, oh my God, this poor man. I feel like he gives the most underrated performance of this film, because everybody speaks of Toni Collette, and curse you, Academy. Why didn't you give this woman a nomination? Everybody has their thorns regarding major awards and who got one, who should have gotten one, whatever, who shouldn't have won one. This is a massive snub. I don't know how you don't give her a nod, because she's absolutely brilliant in so many different scenes, which we'll get into. But Gabriel Byrne is so understated, and he's the man on the brink the whole time. He's the sanest one, and he's been, you think about the history of this family, how wackadoo her mother must have been, how you've got this little girl who the mother is obsessed with, the grandmother is obsessed with. You've got Annie's family history. You know, I have loved ones who have really you know, unfortunate and terrible histories with their families where, you know, you have to sort of support that person and protect that person in what they've been through and how they've come out the other side. So he's there for her, even though she's got a brother who committed suicide because he was identified as being schizophrenic. This goes to your thing about the mental illness. She reveals in, I hope listeners are with me because I am really all over the road at this point, no pun intended, but you have her sitting in this grief circle for her mother. So this is early on. She sits down and she's new and they invite new people to speak. So she gets in there and she says, so, you know, my family has always been estranged. I was estranged from my mother for years. My father starved himself to death. Did he drown or did somebody else drown?
No, that was Ann Dowd's kids. He starved himself to death.
You're right. Too many deaths to track. Okay. So he was a psychotic depressive. He drowned himself when she was a baby. So she never really knew her father. Her brother was schizophrenic. And at 16, hanged himself, blaming his mother for trying to put people inside him. And now you've got the mother who's a little on the odd side. She was diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder eventually. She had dementia at the end. And if you've ever lost someone who eventually devolves into dementia, it's a heartbreaking situation. So she really, you know, her family had all of these struggles. We come to find out by the end of all this that none of it is authentic, that the son, the brother was really, the mother really was trying to put Payman inside him. So this poor thing who was hearing all of these voices and hallucinating and seeing all of these situations actually was. And so this poor thing killed himself to avoid all of it. I can only imagine the father with the psychotic depression. I can only imagine what he saw because I'm seeing edges of it in Steven. She reveals all of this early on. And I think people dismiss it because they see the movie once and they go, oh, it's about grief and it's about mental illness. But if you don't really pay attention and you struggle to keep details like that in your brain when you watch a film, you forget that she's revealed everything up front. That's a throwaway line. You know, he wrote in a note that my mother was trying to put people inside him. Well, because you heard schizophrenic, you've already dismissed him.
Yeah. Why I like to. This is not a mystery.
No, it's all there, but you may not know the pieces are there. I have rambled so much.
No, I love it. And, you know, I had my chance, you had your chance, and that's why I have you on, because I respect your opinion. And I really feel like a lot of people who I really respect their opinions love this movie. And then there's me, I guess.
You don't respect your own opinion, Mark.
No, but see, if I really don't like something that the majority of people love, I like to explore it because, okay, why does this not work for me? Why do I not like this because it's getting too much praise? Do I not like this because of that? I remember when she said that. She's like, he killed himself because she was trying to put people inside of him. I'm like, oh, great. She's trying to, like, after seeing all those symbols and necklaces and focuses, I'm like, oh, she tried to put something inside of him. Like, it wasn't.
Well, you know that now. Yeah. In the beginning of the film on a first watch, you wouldn't have put that together.
I'm telling you, I when she said that. I'm telling you. I didn't see the decapitation coming, but they show the necklace. And then they show.
Wearing it at the funeral.
The weird cult guy staring at them. Yeah. We see the triangles in places. I don't know who all these people are. She'd be weirded out by this. I'm like, yeah, she was part of a cult. And then when she's sitting there and she says he tried to kill himself because she was trying to put people inside of him, I'm like, yeah, that was cult business.
I love it.
It's very odd. And I'm not saying a movie's – I don't think – and the good thing is I'm not saying that I picked up on it when others didn't because I think – Aster, everything in this movie he shows. There are, if you pay attention, you can roll with it. And I like that about him. Like at the end, it's not like twist and then they rewind. And then they show you everything that
you
missed.
Oh God, those scenes.
Let me tell you a story. Well, I put this symbol on the pole. We put a deer there. We knew you'd be stoned and you would drive. I barf.
Give you the Scooby-Doo ending.
But I'm telling you, when she met Joan and when she met cult. And at the end, when you're watching these cult members and they just want to get rich and they're high in this movie, it's what I respect it, but Ari Aster, they highlighted things in books and underline things in books. Yep. He wants you to see all of this. He wants to tell you all of this. So I think maybe for 99% of people that works. But then when I watched it, I was like, oh, okay. And then when she started chasing him and floating on the wall.
Oh, my God. You tell me you didn't like that, Mark. Really?
I just kind of went,
ugh. It still unsettles me. I watched it the other night to prep for talking with you. And I went to, I don't know why I make these decisions, because normally it doesn't bother me. That's why I make these decisions. I watched it late at night. Like, I think I started it at 12:45. So the movie finishes after like 1:30, and I'm going to bed, and we've got these vaulted ceilings. Like, I live in the house that my grandfather built. And so there used to be a garage in our family room, and now it's all like knotty pine walls. And so we've got that vaulted ceiling where, you know, the garage essentially would have been. And so I'm turning lights off and I'm looking, I'm going, no, Toni Collette is not creeping in the corner of my ceiling right now. Like, it still affected me, even though I know it's not real, but it's like her lurking above him, her son, Peter, when he's in bed and he wakes up and you just, there's something on the ceiling over him. Like, that's creepy. I think that's so good. And then when she like float crawls out and then he comes out to find his father and she's on the ceiling again. I think that's amazing. Like, I want to go back and see this in the theater with people who've never seen it before and listen to those people spot her.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff I love about watching horror films is the reactions of people around me.
Fly on the wall, watch them, see what's going on.
I love it.
When they ran upstairs, though, you see the cult members, and then you see the bodies, and then you see the bodies bent in the treehouse. You're like, when did the cult do this? And the fact that they do it all for money, it's just, like, I watched Dark and the Wicked, and like The Strangers, The Dark and the Wicked is about a family who is estranged, and this demon found somebody who was weak and preyed on this person. And then the family comes home and makes it worse. The mom was holding out for a long time, but then you get this family element, dysfunctional, not believing each other, making each other weak, going into old patterns, leaving each other. That's tragic.
And there was some dementia there too, wasn't there? Or was it perceived dementia? It's been a little while since.
Yeah, so the father was just went downhill. And the mom didn't have dementia.
Still in the bed. You're absolutely right.
The mom told everyone to leave, like, get out of here. And then when they came and didn't believe her, she had that weakness inside of her. Yes. And this demon just preys on the weak. That's what scares me. In Session 9, the presence in that, it's just like, I prey on the weak.
Now you bring this up and you talk about a movie everybody loves that you don't. Session 9 does not work for me.
Yeah, oh, man. When Simon, like that Simon, just like, I prey on the weak. And I loved how Josh Lucas's character seemed squirrely at first and the other kid, but they weren't the weak ones. It was the man who was tired and just hearing how evil, I guess what I'm talking about is the evilness of it. Simon was evil.
That insidious under the surface evil. I'm with you.
And listen, I know that Gray is fine, but at the end of the day, this is just a cult who wants some extra pocket change.
Like, I love that that's what you come down to. Like, it's just down to the money.
Like, they just want money. If they were really evil, they would follow Simon. If they were really evil, they would follow the Dark and the Wicked demon. Like, we want darkness. No, we want our pockets filled with gold coins.
I don't know. I don't know that I agree that it was just for the money.
Well, they're not following the other seven.
No, they're not. But this is the god of mischief. This is the god of I'm going to screw with you for my entertainment.
But also brings a lot of pocket change.
Well, I mean, you need to keep your audience, so there's going to be money involved.
The other gods probably didn't offer that. Like, hey, I bring tacos. Like, we're not going to bring this person to life.
Tacos. Who doesn't love tacos? What's wrong with this cult?
I mean, free tacos, like a good ones, like fish tacos, like fresh cod. Like, are we talking
This is like the apple of discord. This is like Greek classic mythology of how the Trojan War began, right? Like, you get this squirrely little dude and these three goddesses who want this apple that says for the fairest. And Zeus takes one look at this apple and he goes, I am not touching this competition. You've got Hera, you've got Aphrodite, and you've got Athena saying, Zeus, which one of us gets this apple? And he goes, do not ask me. I'm not getting in this fight. So they find this squirrely little human being named Paris, and they each offer him something. And so I feel like this is Payman's cult apple. You know, like, Hera offers Paris to be the most powerful man in the world. Athena offers him that he's going to be a war hero and is respected. And Aphrodite says, I'm going to give you the love of the most beautiful woman in the world. And I'm going to make a cliche comment, and I'm going to say the little guy wanted the woman. And if I were a less classy individual, I would say something different than woman. Limp Bizkit has a song about it. Let's go to that instead. You know, like, he makes this decision and starts a whole war. I feel like this cult is, you know, looking for their bag of money that says, for the stupidest. Like, yeah. We are the cult. We have eight gods that we could raise, and we're going to go with the dude who brings us the money.
Right? That's not scary.
This is so funny.
That's not scary.
I guess not.
Like, that's just, what's scary is Simon from Session 9. What's scary is Blackcoat's daughter. Like, Dark and the Wicked. That's scary. Strangers. That's scary.
Why are you doing this? Because you were home.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me a better line in horror. Give me one. You cannot find it. I'll wait.
So yeah, I gotta love that line.
Because you were home. Great.
Oh. I would be like, well played. I'm horrified of you right now, but respect.
That movie teaches you, do not answer the door at 2 in the morning. It's so basic. Don't answer the door. If your doorbell rings at 2 in the morning, don't answer it. You're not home. You're asleep. You didn't hear the doorbell.
Get your shotgun. It's get a baseball bat. But like, yes. So at the end of this movie, Annie goes, why are you doing this, Joan? I'm just making up a scene. Because we want that change. She's like, because we want to raise Payman. And and then
minimum
Annie goes, doesn't he give you a lot of riches, too? Well, that's fine as well. I'll take that. Cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Sure.
I dig it.
Well, I mean, think about it. They're stalking their home. They've got a pretty gorgeous home.
And they're surrounded naked. They're standing around naked. Because naked bodies, I read, sorry to interrupt you, they said naked bodies can capture magic easier. That's why they're all buck naked in their house.
I love that you found this out. I did not even do any research.
Yeah, I read all about it. Like, I know about the miniatures. I know about the production design. I know about all the shots. I know about why they were naked. Because they can get, like, magic into their bodies better.
I don't want to be in any cult that makes me wear clothes. I'm not into that.
You can't get magic as well. The teacher. I have 5 pages of note, and I barely began to use them.
But I know. This is going to be a long episode.
The teacher, he's talking to his class. Like, there's no control.
Right.
What did he say? Like, he's studying Greek tragedies.
Yes. And he's reading Sophocles with them.
And it's like, this is just going to happen. It's out of their control.
Right.
And Ari Aster said this is a conspiracy movie without exposition, told from the perspective of the people being conspired against. So, but it's not. They have this conspiracy. But all right, so Rosemary's Baby, right?
Yes.
I mean, obvious parallels. I mean, so many movies have gone after Rosemary's Baby, like copied that. They want the Antichrist born.
Yes.
Like that's not good, but they still do it.
Right.
That's scary.
You know what? That's why we're getting Payman, because somebody already took the Antichrist. The reason we're
left
with Payman is because cults got there first.
The taco demon got him.
Somebody already snagged that one. So these people went, well, I guess we'll take this mischief guy.
And they're talking about how they never had the choice. They're hopeless. And so, yeah, the 40 years. Wait, no. I think this cult. When was Rosemary's Baby made?
68.
Okay, so then that was what? 78, 88, 98, 68. She could have still been working. Because how old is Toni Collette in this movie, do you think?
I don't know, but I know that Gabriel Byrne is 22 years older than she is, and the man looks good. I am putting this out there. Like, Gabriel Byrne is one of those Silver Fox kinds of guys.
Maybe this gang knew.
He's maybe 40. I'd say 40, because her son is in high school. You know, so I'd put her maybe in her early 40s-ish.
Okay. So let's say she was born in 75 or 76, 77. Rosemary's Baby was already out.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe
she would have grown up with it.
Yeah, so maybe they already took this. But you know what I'm saying, right? That's scary.
I do.
Like,
it
here's
is.
The Antichrist. I love it, though. Like, we got the Antichrist. You get the Taco God. He already got taken.
Taco God is my fit. Hashtag Taco God. Forget Taco Cat.
It's just, I don't know. And then just I love when teachers start talking about that stuff, though, because the teacher is like, "Yeah, there's no hope," and you're like,
"Well,
ugh.
That's the Greek." Well, see, the English teacher is going to speak now, Mark. So you've got, as an English teacher who teaches Sophocles, not the play they're talking about, but we do Oedipus Rex, and he's talking about the hero. A lot of what he's talking about kind of mushes some Joseph Campbell and some classic Greek tragic hero stuff, but he talks about how the hero runs into trouble because they're trying to change their fate and they're trying to make decisions. And every last teacher, professor, whatever, whoever teaches Oedipus Rex and the Oedipus cycle is dealing with this idea of, you know, fate versus free will. I try not to go there because they pick up on it anyway. But, you know, what is the point? What is it you're trying to learn when with the Greeks watching these plays and performances and these festivals? P.S. to Dionysus or Dionysus, however you want to pronounce it, potato, potato. These festivals were put out there for the patron saint god of debauchery, right? The patron saint of frat houses, the guy wanted wine and revelry. They would have these festivals. It's very similar to Paimon, who likes mischief and messing with people, which is what the Greek gods did. I'm finding more connections than what I even wrote down before. I'm liking this even more now. But, you know, like these, I think what Astor is trying to do is do that whole, what he's learning about is what's happening to him. And, you know, they are destined
clearly,
that
for
this
sure.
is what's going to happen, which is kind of one of those movie tropes anyway. Like if you've got a kid in school, they have to be learning about what's going to happen to them.
A movie just came out recently, too, with that same exact thing. Oh, Brightburn. Holy crap.
There you go.
Same thing. Wasps.
Yep, all of them.
And I guess that's just another thing where the teacher says that, and I went, oh, yep, of course.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
I don't know why I was so surly about it, because I guess we were just going towards a disaster. And I guess if I was closer with the characters, I would be afraid of that, right? I think that might have happened. Now, listen, like you said, Alex Wolff, watching this movie again, his reactions at that dinner table are exceptional. And also, he's an awesome, like, he was just on Rotten Tomatoes is Wrong talking about M. Night Shyamalan movies.
Yep.
And he is, like, wonderfully eloquent, knows a lot about movies. You basically want to be his best friend and talk movies with him all day. Toni Collette is wonderful. Gabriel Byrne is wonderful. I mean, Everybody's good in this movie. And listen, the sets that they built and the wide shots to create look of the miniature that
the
they are making
through these sets. Incredible.
Wonderful shot. I mean, this is in everyone builds sets, right? But they built sets to scale that they are miniatures in this. And when I first saw the opening shot, when it goes through the miniature into the room onto Alex Wolff, you're thinking to yourself, and then when she started making these little miniatures, and then when I started realizing that they're just screwed, and then she's making these, I was like, oh, okay, because like they're in this, like, and then the framing is like this. I don't, you know, it's, I don't know why. I just kind of, I keep saying this, and I teach this movie. So I teach film. I teach production design.
I
teach film, I show them stuff from Hereditary because I think it's brilliant set building, and I think this movie did something important for horror, and that you and I, you know, we grew up watching horror movies. So I was born in 82. I started watching horror movies probably like when I was 8. So about 1990. You have the local Blockbusters. We didn't have Netflix. Like, I don't think I had like a lot of cable. Like I wouldn't watch horror movies with my family. So a lot of the horror movies I watched were, I would go to the theaters. So I grew up on 90s horror. Frighteners blew my mind, but we also had Scream 2, I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yes.
And so that carried us through. Then the early 2000s with all horror remakes. And that's why I love the A24 era of horror, because we are getting sets like this. We're getting performers in these films. We are getting...
You're getting artistic horror.
Exactly. Like late 70s. Like this is horror. Like this is 70s. Late 60s, 70s horror. We're kind of in that heyday again. And I think it's wonderful because it's an art form.
Yes.
I guess for me, I keep saying this over and over again, but going back to those miniatures, you're just thinking, yeah, all right, cool. I feel so jaded, but you know me, I'm not like the jaded dude.
No, not at all.
But I don't know, for some reason, I think I appreciate that Astor never once tries to put something over your head. I think it takes swagger to present everything to you. And
yeah, I think so too. And to say, like, look, here it is. I'm not going to try and trick you. I don't think this is a film that's out there trying to trick you. But I think this is a kind of horror that, again, relies on that dread that, oh, God, I know what's coming. And yet I can't do anything to stop it. And I think that various characters feel edges of that. I think Steve is watching his wife completely fall apart. I think he's trying to protect his son, who is watching, maybe not literally, figuratively, watching his doom come to him, but he doesn't know what it is, and he doesn't know if he's just going nuts. Because besides, he's a high schooler. You know, he's dealing with crazy hormone situations anyway. He's watching his mom, whom he woke up one day and had covered him in paint thinner and is standing over him with a match. So, yeah, I'm going to be a little uncomfortable in my own bed, too. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's more about we, the viewers, we're the voyeurs looking into this dollhouse, right? You know, take that metaphor and really run with it. So she's somebody who builds miniatures, and her new show is going to be focused around, like, her own experiences. And so we get an edge of a scene that we didn't get. We actually got two of them, where you've got mom in hospice slowly dying. Grandma. And then you've got Annie and Steve in bed with the grandmother standing in the doorway, kind of looking over them. My brain started making stories for that. Like, is this that childlike thing where, mom, I can't sleep. I'm having a nightmare. I'm coming to the bedroom. Is it the grandma looking over them going, I've got things in store for you? Like, is it insidious? Is it childlike? Is it, you know, I need some water and I can't remember where the kitchen is? Like, there's so many things that could happen in that scene. And then you know, as the film goes on and she's got the whole house, she's got Peter's room, and then she's got like this preschool or whatever from their background. And then she starts making the accident, you know, and Stephen walks in and she's working on painting the blood on the street.
Yep.
Where Charlie's head has landed nearby to the pole. The car is there kind of skewed. And Stephen goes, what the hell are you doing? You know, has Peter seen that? And she goes, why does that matter? It's not about him. And it's just like, what is happening in this moment? Like, you think Steve has got to be losing his mind watching her lose hers.
Absolutely. You know, yeah.
It's this incredible, I don't know how the man gets through this situation. Like, you think about character development. You think about Gabriel Byrne as an incredible character actor and how he must have put together who Steve is and who Steve was and why he's such a quiet character watching his entire family fall apart. He comforts Annie in her agonizing grief when Charlie is killed. We never see Steve's grief for that event. And he can't because she is so bad about it. You know, she's falling apart. You know, like, I think about her agonizing screams and I just want to die. And I'm not a parent. I don't know that kind of fear. And heaven forbid anybody ever find out, you know, what it's like if their child dies before them. You know, these are awful, awful, awful things. The way her child dies, like, now let's add that on top of everything else. This is why people say it's about grief. And I think grief is secondary to the dread. The how do you go through life knowing there's nothing good ahead of you? And I think that's what's happening here.
Absolutely. You're right. Because the grief is all manufactured by this cult. It's about...
Right.
Like, and I really think that Steve was the grandma's worst nightmare. Because you want to have this cult, the mom, they created instability in the family. They wanted to weaken them. They wanted to take the daughter. The mom had her history with her dad and her brother. Her mom led her to believe this.
They want the daughter because Annie won't let her mother anywhere near her son at first.
And I think Steve is part of that strength.
I think so too.
Steve was the worst nightmare because he's the level-headed one. He probably knows how horrible the mom was.
Yep.
Why they gave the daughter to the mom is odd. Like, I am not going to let you have my son, but I know that you are horrible, but I'm going to let you have my daughter.
I think she just wore down.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe.
I think they got complacent, maybe. I don't know. It's speculation.
And also, it's really interesting reading what they have to say about this, because from the director, Charlie was Payman from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
From the moment she's born, there was this girl that was displaced, but she was displaced from the very beginning. And what's interesting is this Payman, it's a very docile creature in this girl.
Yeah. And she just kind of watches everything.
In her soul, taken over. And that's why at the end, when Charlie, they say Charlie to Peter, because they got Charlie's soul as well. It's the mom really wanted to create weakness, and I think she got unlucky with Steve, because Steve didn't cut and run. Steve seems very forgiving. Clearly, Annie is very talented at what she does. She is wildly talented at her miniatures.
Yes.
So I think he is just dealing with all of this around. And also, he is a bit docile, too, which is a detriment, but he seems to be a good influence, and so I think that was the mom's worst nightmare. But it's interesting how the plot really ramps up after the grandma's death.
Yeah.
That's when we really start seeing things. Like, she was estranged for a long time, then she came back, then she died. Do you think the grandma didn't want to turn it on? Do you think the cult stepped up to kill Charlie after? Because I don't know.
Oh, no,
really...
I think she did, because she leaves that letter, that little note for Annie.
Yeah, you're going to get some change.
Says, yeah, where she talks about, no, not the change.
Our sacrifices will pale next to the change in our pockets.
Yes, it's like, you know, the rewards that you're going to get. And she basically says, you know, I'm sorry, essentially for, like, what you're going to go through. And it says, you know, stuff about, I don't remember where I wrote it down.
You're going to be like Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah, it's this thing where it's, oh, there it is. The rewards outweigh the sorrow. You know, like, don't grieve the losses, because the rewards outweigh the sorrow. And you're just like, what? You know, and she dismisses it because her mother wasn't well at the end. And you have this, I don't know. I think that's what we're watching. We're watching this film like Sophocles. You know, I bring back the Greek tragedy things. Like, theater goers would go to these plays knowing the story.
It's a tragedy. You go to see a tragedy, right? And you, so that, I'm not.
They would recognize stories. That would be like us going to see Beauty and the Beast and expecting to see something different. You know the story. You just want to see how this new version is told.
And also, too, you go, like, you know, Shakespeare's tragedies. Are we going to a Shakespeare play? Oh, it's his new tragedy. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, you know, Macbeth is dying. So, you know. Yeah. Chaos is coming.
You do. And it's just watching it unfurl. This is the catharsis of Greek theater. You know, the expenditure of pity and fear. And that's exactly what this movie is. Pity and fear.
I guess, you know, I just never connected.
Poor schmuck, you know. It's really what it is. It's pity for this family. And I'm telling you, I wrote down the words, poor Steve. You know, Steve gets my pity left and right in this film. And I think that's what he was going for.
All these poor schmucks are dying so people can get change.
God, and I mean, that. Can we talk about the poll? Can we talk about
how about this? Let's take a quick break, and then we'll talk about the poll. Then I got another really interesting thing to talk to you about. How's that sound?
Yes, I love it.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. And before we get into the poll, I just want to talk about the scene where Joan corners Annie at the craft store.
Yes.
I thought it was really interesting what Anne Dowd was doing, where whenever Annie looked away, Joan would pull her eyes back to her.
Right. Get that eye contact
and
again.
It was so evident. Once again, I knew what was going on. But she just kept, look at me, look at me, look at me. Mm. She's just, they are just guiding this woman.
Like, yes.
She knows exactly what she's doing. And I like those little moments in there, because that's not something, they never tell you it. They show you it, and I love that. That's one thing I do like. But, yeah, she keeps pulling her back to do the eyesight, because you need that eyesight there to do that.
That's your connection.
But she's almost desperate in this scene, because they try to slip the flyer under there for the seance. That doesn't work. So then they put in a splinter agent, because they got to get their money. So then they throw Joan in there, and then Joan was her desperation. This group seemed very desperate towards the end, because I think they know that they're so splintered at this moment. They know that Charlie's death splintered them even further, and that's their best way to get in, because of grief. You know, you make bad decisions sometimes when you're hurt
I
and
agree.
You're sad. So it's just these people manipulating them to so they can get those gold coins in their pockets, so
yep.
they can have all that, let it rain. And they, I just thought that was interesting. I thought it was pretty cool how she did
it. It is. It's just, and like, she's very slick with her manipulation because she knows. She's like, yes, I know your reaction. Yes, I'm going to have the same reaction. You know, like, she's not just this, obsessed individual who's like, oh my God, this was so wonderful. Oh my God. She goes, no. I know what I sound like. I get it. I had the same reaction, but trust me, like, you got to just come see it for yourself. And then once she sees it, that's it. She's in, you know, she knows she's got her.
Yeah. Don't translate this. Just say it.
Yeah. Oh God, that was so funny. Like, here's this piece of paper. Here's what you read. Don't worry about what it means. Just say it exactly as it is. And she says it and it's like, oh dear, what are you doing?
And I don't know, you know, so I love that it's a tragedy. I love that we know where it's going, but I guess I was never invested in any of the characters. So then the drama and the tragedy and the ensuing car crash didn't hit me, if that makes sense. And also,
it's the staggering nature of this accident. I mean,
they show the face.
Oh my God. What, which face?
Her, are you talking about Charlie's face that's just laying on the ground?
That's what I thought you were talking. I mean, that's the other thing. Like, they drag out this sequence to that you go, okay, they're not going to show it. And then they show it. It's like, oh my God, with the ants. It's just like, oh, you finally lulled me into assuming you weren't going to show it. And then you bastards flashed it at me. It's like, ah, this sequence. Now, I'm a crazy person and I actually tracked the timestamps for this sequence. This whole thing. From when he slams on the brake, right? So it's when she gets hit, when she hits her head, to like when he slams on the brake. So it's like 33 minutes and 30 seconds is when this occurs, right? We look at the car. You want to talk about these wide shots. We're looking at the pole on the left and the car on the empty street. By the way, this street has no other poles on it. It's this random pole.
With a marking on it.
It's with the marking on it, of course. And you just see the car with like the brake lights on. This takes 11 seconds before we go inside the car. Already, wow. We're going to make you wait because you are in the middle of, oh shit, what just happened? Can I swear?
Yeah.
Okay.
We got the explicit label on our podcast, so it's fine.
Oh, so I can swear more. Good to know.
We keep it PG-13. I think you can drop unlimited shit bombs. Well, oh, I don't know if you want to drop those, but
we'll get George Carlin in here to run off those words. So it's 11 seconds before we go in there. It's another 20 seconds. No, yeah, 20 seconds from the interior to when Peter is just kind of staring. I can't imagine like the acting in that 20 seconds, because 20 seconds to stand still is a long time. It's longer than you expect. And he's just staring. It's 20 seconds before he even glances it to the rearview mirror. And then you've got a couple of seconds. It's 40 seconds. It's 34:06 to 34:46 before he removes his foot from the brake pedal. 40 seconds from when he glances to the rear view and can't look, and he just sits there. It's 40 seconds of just sitting there in this, oh my God, what's he going to do? Oh my God, what is he thinking? Oh my God, what just happened? Like, your brain is spinning. Then he drives home at 35:30. He gets out of the car. 19 seconds were in the interior of the hallway. Okay. When he gets into the hallway, it's 6 seconds later before you hear Annie say to Steve, okay, good, they're home, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody comes out to say anything. He doesn't go, because I remember seeing this the first time going, is he going to tell them? What do you do? Like, how do you go home and say, Mom, Dad, there's been an awful accident? How? I can't, even now, I have no word for what the hell, the guilt, the agony, the grief, the blame. That you were driving the car when your little sister was decapitated because you brought her to a party and she accidentally asphyxiated. Like, there's so many layers to this. I'm going to keep going. Bear with me. So almost half a minute later is when he enters the bedroom, gets into bed. And now you have that dissolve. So now we're at 36:47, right? We're 3 minutes after the scene the sequence has begun. I started at 33:30. I'm at 36:47 now. We have this dissolve from where night has now moved on. Morning has come. And at 36:54, we hear her say, I'm running out to get some balsam wood. We hear the door open at 37:02. We hear the car door open. I had the captions on. It says car door opens at 37:12. Annie gasps at 37:15. So from when Peter wakes, is awake in bed, because he never goes to sleep. He just lies there. 36:47. Peter awake, lying in bed. The scream begins at 37:18. So that's what, 20, 30, yeah, 30-ish, 40-ish seconds before the scream begins. Because then the scream continues through a set of scenes where she's rocking on the floor. This is 37:18 to 37:34, more 20-second stretches of this. And it all ends at 39:04, where they're at the cemetery. P.S. The headshot you're looking for is at 37:35. The cemetery, they're burying Charlie. The casket is being lowered into the ground, and it fades from the dirt to black at 39:04.
The very colorful coffin.
Yes. Oh, I want to talk about the colors. Because there's blue and there's red everywhere in this film.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere. So almost 5.5 minutes, maybe 5:40. For this entire sequence. And you don't hear music. You just have silence. You have dread. You have tension. And the sound that Toni Collette makes in this agony is just, it sits with you. It absolutely sits with you.
No, I had to go through this.
I had to go through this with you because I couldn't. It's such a staggering sequence of gut punch, you know?
I guess the logistics of it all makes it. It's so expertly performed, and I feel dead inside for not hating it, but the cult members put their symbol on that pole, put a dead deer in the road, and just cross their fingers. That just
pretty
makes
much.
It... Can I ask you something? You love villains. What would you rate these villains as? I know the movie isn't about the villains, but...
Frankly, I really like the dude who's smiling. Like the grinning guy at
creepy.
The funeral.
Yeah.
And then he's standing in the dark doorway at the end, and he's just grinning. There's something really unnerving. I mean, this is why the Joker works so well. You know, there's something really unnerving about somebody who's just grinning at you in a really awkward, awful, terrible situation.
Yeah, he's looking at payment like, hey.
Oh, my God.
You're like, going to give me money soon.
And he's standing there naked. And so, of course, you can't help but check to make sure he's naked. And he's still got that grin. And it's just like, ugh. It's just so many uncomfortable situations in this film, one right after the other, that you never get away from.
The mom that was the queen, Lisa. The mom was the queen. So she got married to Payman.
Yeah. She gave up her soul to Payman.
I mean, is that... Did Payman want that?
I don't know.
Like, who...
Was she queen of the cult? I mean,
why
is
just
that
her
one?
Family? Because she is married to him.
The one who offered them. Maybe. I mean, that's a good question.
And everyone else is like, yeah. Well, I mean, I like my mom, so I mean, you can do it. You can totally do it. I'll go get naked and I'll stand in the woods.
I just want to reap the benefits. Yeah. You know, I just don't want to actually do it.
Yeah, the mom did all the work. So does she get all the money and then she gives the money? Like who?
Where are these rewards?
Yeah. I mean, now how are they splitting them? Oh, you know what? I want to see a movie afterwards about how the cult just fall apart because of their newfound wealth.
It's in white. It comes up during the fade to black at the end of the narrative, and it says, the cult, after they received their riches, which cult member, creepy grinning dude, blew his money at Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut. And
Hereditary 2, greed.
What they did with their money.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Right? Like they're gonna tear each other apart.
Yes. Oh, totally.
And is Payman gonna rule over? He's a ruler of hell on earth.
Yes.
Is he psych? Because we saw the illustrations. They have three heads. They decapitated the heads. They did all this.
Yeah.
Like, do they get money? Like, you've only been in the club for 6 months. You only get $10 million. Like you've
I know,
been.
Right?
Is the IRS gonna deal with this? Like what? Hey, we got a cult.
That's
in
cult accountant.
Yeah, we there's this group out there, and they're bunch of rich people. Like, what's going on with
them? Walking into like H&R Block and being like, hey, we got our taxes. Can we like file jointly?
Yeah. It says here you made, wait, let me, $8 billion last year? Like, how'd you do that? Well, we raised
a... sell your soul to get this? Yeah. Oh, that guy. Oh,
how'd you get this money? Oh, I sold my soul.
No, I found
oil. I found some oil.
Yeah, right.
It's... That's hilarious. That dude blew his money in a casino in Jersey.
I'm telling you.
Bet it on black. Oh, I need another demon.
That's it.
Sorry to hate on this. And I know... I guess just the core concept of it. And I think it is possible to admire in a movie. It just kept me at such a length. I don't know why. And then, you know, I as you were breaking down that scene, one thing I do like about this movie is I do feel like a lot of, for lack of a better word, art house A24 horror films can lean into preciousness, which, you know, we love M. Night Shyamalan movies, but a lot of people after that tried to make an M. Night Shyamalan movie, and they kind of missed the point and just felt precious, a lot of the shots. This movie does not, and I love that about it. It's not overly precious. It's, I just got a guy, cult member, blowing his money in Jersey.
Yeah. I just, I mean, not everything, I think not everything's going to be perfect, but I like that you can separate, you know, hey, I don't really feel anything for these people. And, you know, that's a big thing with movies. Most slasher films, like you've brought up earlier, we don't really care for them all that much because we know that they're all expendable in a slasher film. You know, you kind of walk into this one and you go, all right, you're the family that's targeted by the cult. Cool. I know I shouldn't put too much stock in you because you're not going to be around all that long. I think you do have a really interesting scene when Steve bursts into flame because it's built up so much that if she throws the sketchbook into the fire, she's going to catch fire.
Psych.
And it turns. Yeah, it's like, nope, we're going to go after this guy now because he's the one who's in our way and we're tired of you. You know, I think that was a great little turnaround. I think you can kind of see that coming because you're like, oh, I feel like something bad's going to go here. And boom, it's him. I don't know. I think that Toni Collette's facial expressions too in this, I keep coming back to her, especially in that moment, because she's just looking at him and she's got that face of pure horror, and then she just lets her face relax. And you can tell she's just gone. She is not there anymore.
And took her over.
Oh, it's just like that is finally when Annie disappears. Like she can't, she's just not there anymore. Whether it was a psychotic break, whether her consciousness was taken over by whatever it is that makes her crawl up the wall. She's just gone. At that point, Annie is not home.
No, she's gone. And also, a lot of people have said that Peter dies at the end, but I don't believe that because Annie's brother killed himself and they couldn't use that vessel anymore. If Peter jumps out that window and snaps his neck, that won't be a vessel anymore. So I've read a lot of stuff online saying that Peter killed himself and that allowed Paimon to enter his body. I think what allowed Paimon to, the demon to enter his body was the sheer amount of weakness, as in like Session 9, Blackcoat's Daughter, The Dark and the Wicked. He had just been run so far into the ground that his body then became able to be inhabited. Did you read it that way?
So I'm thinking about it now because in that moment, so various parts of this film, you have this refracted light that sweeps across the screen, or it's this little, you know, it sweeps across and then it becomes that sunspot on the wall, or, you know, he's in class and it swings by and then he looks at the reflection of his face in the cabinet or whatever. So you have that. When he leaps out of the window, there's this black shadow that leaves his body and the refracted light spot, whatever it is, goes into his body. So I'm wondering, because then when he climbs into the treehouse, they greet him, Joni greets him as Charlie. So it's one of two things. So that, and then you look at it. So bear with me as I talk myself through this. So the black shadow that leaves his body could be Peter's soul leaving. And then his body is inhabited by Paimon, who they climb up into the thing. But when they refer to him as Charlie, so I wonder if he was possessed by, let's say, three entities. Let's say he's got Charlie, let's say he's got Peter, and let's say he's got Payman. I think it's possible that he was carrying Charlie's soul already and Payman, because she was his vessel. And the light that finally goes in there is like Payman, I guess. Maybe he did leave. Maybe his soul is the one that's released. The alternative is that it's Charlie's soul that is finally released, because she has now done her job and they don't need her anymore, because now they've got the male body. And so then Peter is trapped in there with Payman.
Oh, that
I've talked
like
myself.
Fun.
Yeah, there's two different possibilities here, because Charlie, like you said earlier, was there the whole time while Payman was possessing her body as a vessel. And
so
you
got Charlie, Payman, and Peter in there?
I think there's a possibility for that, because Charlie's soul was in that house because she possesses Annie when Annie does that seance, and like everything gets really creepy because she's crying and saying, "Mom, what's going on?" And she's like yelling "Mom" until Steve throws that glass of water at her and like shocks her out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if maybe she jumped into Peter in that moment. I don't know if she's been in Peter the whole time. I don't know if she's just been aligned with Payman. I can't pin this down for you now that I think about it.
Because people said he died, but if the guy hung himself, they couldn't move forward with that.
Right. So I definitely think there's a soul. I'm gonna inception this, and I'm going to say I don't know what it is, but I can argue many possibilities.
Yeah, and I mean, either way, Paimon's there. Paimon.
Oh,
Paimon,
yeah.
Paimon, tomato, yeah, tomato. Tomato.
Yep.
I saw a shirt once that said, like, I say tomato. Wait, you say tomato. Wait, you say tomato, I say F you. I'm like, what? So, listen. Okay, we've covered a lot.
We have.
Do you want to do something real quick? Do you want to do an A24 horror movie draft that people can vote on at MFF?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to pull up A24 horror movies. I'll give you first pick since I'm so nice.
Okay.
And we'll start drafting. So you get first pick, and you can pick whatever you want. You can go
How
as big.
How many are you going to? Five?
Five. You can go as big or little as you want. I don't care. You can even take this first pick.
I don't know that I'm going to. I want to dodge your expectations.
Hey.
Because I have some that I almost want to fight you for, but I'm interested to see where you're going to go. I'm going to choose The Witch first.
Oh, The Witch. Robert Eggers.
Oh, it's so good.
A baby gets turned into goo.
That movie, that was another one where I was like, oh, we're going to go there. Okay.
Baby goo. I love it. I love that movie. I'm going to take Green Room because I like the band before they get in there.
Yeah.
I like how outmatched they are. And I like how the violence is just so fast and brutal and mean and plays so real.
It really is.
It's my favorite horror. Like that and Black Coats are my two favorite. And Climax are my two favorite horror movies, three favorite horror films of the last 10 years. Yeah. All right. Your second pick.
All right. I'm going to go Hereditary.
Oof. I've lost already. I'm going to get zero votes, but I don't care. I'm taking The Black Coat's Daughter because I love The Black Coat's Daughter, and it really, I want you to watch it so I can, like, so we've covered it on the pod.
I'll watch it tonight.
Wait, I just spelt The Black Boat's Daughter. You got boat in me here. What's going on?
Because I got Boatman's Daughter, which I've been sitting here looking at going, I need to read that so I can watch the movie. And you are now the one who has revealed to me that it's not the same text. So I will watch Black Coat's Daughter today.
Oh, it's so good. All right, who you got? What horror movie you got next?
I'm going Midsommar. I have to.
Midsommar.
Oh, another one. One right after the other. Ari Aster, I was like, I am on board. I will see his films sight unseen. I do not care. One after the other, these two films, it was like a gut punch. Incredible.
All right, I'm going to take...
I will say, with Midsommar, I don't like that they brought back that agonized, you know, screaming thing. I'm like, nope, we've already done that. You can't have it in both movies. But go ahead.
I'm going to take... Climax.
Okay.
Because have you seen Climax?
I have not.
So it's directed by Gaspar Noé, and it's about this dance troupe it's a French dance crew, and the beginning of the film features this amazing dance sequence where they're all in line. They're all in just this, like, they're all in sync. And then someone spikes their sangria with LSD.
Ooh.
And it just goes to hell in a handbasket. Very, like, one-shot-esque. Oh, man, I forgot to pick a movie. It goes hell in a handbasket. Just, it becomes just a living hell, the movie, essentially. So, yeah.
Little Suspiria remake?
No. It's okay. There's no, like, witches involved. There's no covens.
Yeah, I mean the dance scenes.
Oh, yeah. But it's unlike any dance you've ever seen. Just type in climax opening, and you'll see the dance, and it's really worth watching.
I'm in. Right. I am in.
What's your fourth pick?
So, I was panicked. I'm like, if he picks this, I'm going to kick myself so hard.
If you pick this, I'm going to kick myself so hard, because I have a movie I just saw I should have picked. What are you doing?
Saint Maud.
Oh.
Is that it?
Nope, but it's so good.
Have you seen, oh my God, this movie. I'm like, I can't. They're so good. One right after the other.
My buddy Billy Crash of Crash Palace Productions, I asked for 2021 movies, and you gave me Mortal Kombat and Judas and the Black Messiah to recommend to watch. And
Saint Maud 2021? Saint Maud was last year, I thought.
It got like released in film festivals, but a lot of people are saying it's 2021, so you can allow it either way.
Oh, I missed it then. Good for him.
All right, so Saint Maud, all right, I'm going to take Under the Skin.
I was debating that one.
I love that movie, and it's a movie you can't recommend it to anybody or talk about it a lot, because a lot of people are like, Mark, what are you watching? Like, I know why you watch that, Mark. It's it's so beautiful. It is played expertly.
That's a film to look at.
Yeah, it's just visually outstanding. I'm not being weird here. I'm just saying it's an expert art film, and I really dig it. So, I mean, I love the Scottish roads. I love the motorcycle shots. I mean, Johansson is just, she takes risks, and I dig that. And I love Under the Skin. So that's my number four. What's your final
one? That's an interesting, well, hang on, because before I go there now I'm going to ramble. So I was on a podcast years ago with some buddies that we called the Blockbuster Brunch, and we did Under the Skin. And I remember being like, what the hell is this movie? Like, I just remember being completely baffled by it. So I need to watch it again and then re-listen to that episode and just be like, because I feel like I was just completely mind blown. I'm like, what is even happening? I just remember being the dissenter of the group because everybody else liked it, I think. And it was just this batshit movie that I was like, what is going on? I remember being like crazy about it. What's my last one going to be? I have two that I'm going between.
I have one. I'm pretty sure you're not going to pick it, so I'm happy.
Yeah, so you're good. You're good. I think you and I have very different, slightly different A24 tastes. So I think this is good because we're really getting teams, we're getting squads together that really reflect us as horror fans, I think. In that vein, I'm going to go It Comes at Night.
Ooh, It Comes at Night. Very good movie.
Which I actually didn't care for much when I saw it in the theater. And it was an absolute example of me not being able to shift my expectations. So I think going back to it, I can sever what I thought it was going to be and watch it for what it is. And it's definitely got that great creepiness to it. So
we did an episode for it and we said it maybe comes at night. Even though I like the movie. That's a movie that everyone complained about the marketing, and it got a D or F cinema score. But I have a question, Lisa. You are a studio exec. You see It Comes at Night and someone's like, all right, cut a trailer for it. You're kind of screwed. And so sometimes when people talk about mismarketing movies, you got to understand, like, how else, like The Village, I think the trailer made it seem like a monster movie, but they didn't want to betray the twist, right?
Right, right. So, and you don't want to just show, you know, a period piece movie because that's not going to put butts in the seats necessarily, or it's going to put the wrong butts in the seats.
So it's like, do you betray the twist? How do you market it? Yeah, I like It Comes at Night, but I was watching this going, I don't know how else they could have cut the trailer. But
yeah, I need to go back and revisit this one.
That guy directed another A24 movie, which I love, called Waves, and I think it's really good. It has Taylor Russell in it from the Escape Room movies and Lost in Space, and it's a really solid film. If you ever get bored, it's definitely worth watching.
That's not on this list that I've got in front of me to help me choose.
I guess it's not a horror movie, though. It's like just an A24 movie,
I guess. Okay.
Now, The Lighthouse is one of my favorite A24 movies.
That crazy.
I don't know if it's a horror movie.
I agree. It's kind of like, is it? Is it?
So I'm not going to add that. I also, but see, if I had to put favorite A24, it would be in my top five, but I don't think it's a horror
movie.
Because
that was one I was debating with. It was either going to be It Comes at Night or The Lighthouse.
And I love The Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
yeah,
very
I don't
detached.
Know about that one.
But I got to go with Life After Beth. And I know it's a okay. comedy. I said I didn't want to add a comedy, but it's a zombie comedy where people are murdered. So right. I am going to go Life After Beth because it's just audacious, and I think Aubrey Plaza is awesome. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to see Life
I
After Beth.
I thought we were going to go Tusk, Mark. I did.
I've dedicated episodes to it. I've watched a documentary. I've listened to the commentaries. I like Tusk. I am a Tusk defender. I do think we've talked about this, but there are scenes watching it. I think I'm repeating myself for the 40th time, but I was watching it. I'm like, yeah, Kevin Smith wrote that the night before. And then on the commentary, he's like, yeah, I wrote this the night before because I wanted to give Genesis Rodriguez a monologue. I'm like, I knew it.
Oh my God. And it's you doing the Will Smith, like, see?
Yeah, exactly. I knew it. It's funny though. I remember that because I always remember my experience because that's the day we closed on our house and I got a call halfway through. My wife was like, we closed on our house. I was like, yeah.
And so this movie is now permanently frozen in your life history.
Absolutely. And then the monologue, I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. He just wrote that the night before. It's funny. But yeah, I love your team. The Witch, Hereditary, Midsommar, Saint Maud, It Comes at Night. And then I have Green Room, The Black Coat's Daughter, Climax, Under the Skin, and Life After Beth. And this is awesome. Like, we had no overlap at all.
None. And yeah, we didn't have to go to blows.
Yeah, listen, you're going to smush me here. This is a 75-25% scenario. But you know me, I don't like play to win. I play to like be happy
it's
with my
squad.
Team. And I'm
right.
not saying
and
you are either. Like, but
yeah, this is also my squad. But I think my squad does have more of the general agreement on it, I think. Because Green Room is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
That is a real good one. And as soon as you said, I went, yeah, that one's off. I'm not going to get it. But that's cool because it's just such a hell of a film.
But Black Coat's Daughter. It's so good. I love Oz Perkins.
I'm gonna see it tonight.
He also wrote I Am the Pretty Little Thing That Lives in the House, and then he also directed Gretel and Hansel.
Which, those are two really stylistic, interesting movies.
Yeah, very – I love his style. And
yeah,
you know what's interesting?
He definitely has a point of view.
One nice thing, too, about Hereditary, it's not a slow burn. Because it burns all the way through.
But I don't know that it burns as quickly as some others,
yeah,
you know?
I mean, but we do get decapitations. We get wild yelling matches.
God.
We get –
that's
strangers
true.
Yelling. Some movies really take their time. I like that.
Yelling, yeah. Get out, Peter! Like, what the hell is happening? Can you imagine being kids sitting nearby at another table? Like, why is this woman yelling at Peter? What is going on?
I'm more cult. They get out, Peter. Give me that change.
Oh, my God. The change.
Give me that pocket money.
Hashtag taco god. Hashtag the change.
Yeah, exactly. And listen, this is a very well-made movie, and I would teach this. I would, if Toni Collette got nominated for an Oscar, I would back her. She doesn't need my backing, but I would be so happy. I guess I just was always at a distance with this movie. And so when people were talking about crying with grief, I was like, this is not a grief movie though, because they're getting played by a bunch of people who want them gold coins.
That's it.
It's so you never like take shelter. You get that grief. You wallow in this grief. And Black Coat's Daughter, to an extent for me, really hurts me, scenes in it, the loneliness of certain scenes. And so I think that that's the grief to me. But yeah, not this one's just watching a family get played by a cult.
Yep, it is, all the way through.
And then what else do you guys do? I don't know.
What are they going to do now is the question.
Yeah.
Like, they've dedicated 40
the
years
IRS.
Of their lives. Yeah, I guess. Because now that's like, well, now that we've got them here, now what?
Would it be a spoiler if I tweeted, like, I want a sequel to Hereditary about how the cult members deal with their new wealth? Do they buy jet skis?
Are they buying a house for payment? Or whose couch is he going to sleep on?
Is the IRS getting involved? Do one of them work for the IRS? Like, does this go to the government? Like, what? I don't know.
We need information.
Give me. But listen, I really appreciate you joining me. It sounds like we both were able to unpack certain things in this.
Sure.
And you know what's interesting? I think I, like with Brightburn, I think I have more of an appreciation for this movie just talking about how beautiful it is and how well acted it is and getting that off my chest. and hearing your breakdown.
I love allowing you to get that vent out. I love joking about it. Like, this has just been super fun.
Because no one talks about the cult gang. No. Nobody, right? Like, nobody. It's quite silly. Like,
it's completely dismissed.
Like, oh wait, do you have our EpiPen? Is there nuts in that thing? And then they cut to someone smacking nuts with a knife.
Right.
This
giant pile of walnuts. Like, how many of these chocolate cakes is she making? Like, what?
Listen, that's why I know that, but the movie's so effective.
It really is.
But also, like, Quiet Place. I have a Quiet Place video in the works with the film theorists, like, how to survive it. But they planted corn, and they harvested corn in that movie. Mm-hmm. But no one talks about that. And, like, why is that nail there? Nobody talks about it because it's a good movie. And yep. I think you can really pass over a lot of things when it's an effective film. So I get it. I like it. And I'm glad we talked about it.
I am too.
Well, thank you for joining me. Hey, do you want to promote your podcast? And then we're going to put your ad on there as well. But do you
I would love it.
Yeah. Do you want to tell people about your show?
Yeah. So my brother and I finally got our act together and we have launched the Sib List. So this is SIBLIST. So think siblings with a list. We're both fiends for movies. We have been our whole lives, you know, brought up on it with our parents. And, you know, so we launched our introductory episode in which we talk about our favorite movies. We talk about what we love about movies. We talked about our earliest movie memories. So you get a little bit of our family history there. And we have finally watched our first film, Lady Hawk. And so that episode will be coming next week. And our premise is simple. We have four movie lists. We have new release as a category. So if that comes up on the wheel, our randomizer, then we'll watch a new release. We have the pop chart fill-in filmography, which has 1,500 movies listed on it, all kinds of categories and subcategories. Although my brother made an error and our randomizer only has 1,498 titles in it. So he missed two somewhere. So at some point down the road, we'll figure out which ones we've missed. And then Mark and I have each come up with a list of doom. And these are movies that, for one reason or another, we have been avoiding. Not necessarily bad movies either. Some Academy Award winning movies on there. Some films that people love, but he or I have been avoiding them. And so these are our four categories. We leave everything up to fate. Since Sophocles came up in Hereditary, might as well talk about it here. Here we leave it up to an internet wheel that tells us what category we're going to watch. And then Mark has put together a big old randomizer spreadsheet with all of the titles put in there. And so we just go with it. And Lady Hawk was our very first film. Neither one of us has seen it. So you get to hear our thoughts next week when that episode drops.
Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Thanks so much. We're excited about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Lisa.
Thanks for having me, Mark. It's always a blast chatting with you.
This was great. All right. So for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and for Lisa Leahy, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you next week.